This show is produced by the Hartman Media Company. For more information and links to all our great podcasts, visit hartmanmedia.com.
Welcome to The Commercial Investing Show, where we analyze, explain, and exploit the opportunities presented in today's commercial property marketplace. If you're interested in apartments, mobile home parks, self-storage facilities, and other income property, you've come to the right place. We'll explore what's hot and what's not in markets nationwide in the relentless pursuit of return on investment. Here's your host, Jason Hartman.
Welcome to the Commercial Investing Show. This is your host, Jason Hartman, where we discuss the relentless pursuit of ROI. Yes, that's right, return on investment and return on inflation. We have a changing future with monetary policy and fiscal policy the way it is, and we need to prepare for it as investors by structuring our transactions differently, and we will talk about that on this episode and future episodes, of course. So we will be back with a fantastic interview for you and a guest today in just less than 60 seconds. Stay tuned.
What's great about the shows you'll find on jasonhartman.com is that if you want to learn how to finance your next big real estate deal, there's a show for that. If you want to learn more about food storage and the best way to keep those onions from smelling up everything else, there's a show for that. If you honestly want to know more about business ethics, there's a show for that. And if you just want to get away from it all and need to know something about world travel, there's even a show for that. Yep, there's a show for just about anything. Only from jasonhartman.com. Or type in Jason Hartman in the iTunes store.
It's my pleasure to welcome Chris Cabanillas to the show. He is an expert on foreclosure law, and he is the owner of Cabanillas Law Firm. Chris, welcome. How are you?
Good, thank you. Thank you for having me on the show.
Good. Well, hey, just in our pre-show quick discussion that we had, you had some very interesting thoughts about foreclosures and shadow inventory and so forth, and the shadow inventory issue has long been debated. I mean, I think I've been talking about this for 7 years easily, maybe longer.
Mm-hmm.
And you know, the problem is nobody really knows, except maybe, I don't know, the Federal Reserve probably knows. I guess Janet Yellen probably has a number. Maybe Fannie Mae does, maybe Freddie Mac too. What are your thoughts on this?
Well, what I'm seeing, and this is just through the experience, I mean, we have offices in 3 states, and they're all judicial foreclosure states. And what I'm seeing is that the number and the length of time it takes to get through judicial foreclosure is taking a very, very long time. It can take several years on average here. But I think even the larger sort of problem, or if you will, the larger reason that the shadow inventory is so big, is that so many people haven't even been sued. So I'm seeing just a ton of people that maybe haven't paid their mortgage in 3 to 5 years. Maybe they've given up hope on getting a loan modification, and yet the entity that owns the loan, and I say entity that owns the loan because even though we always call it banks, it's typically not a bank. It's usually a securitized entity that was created to buy up all the loans. That entity's not proceeding with a foreclosure action against them. And so when you look at this, you have a situation where, you know, the foreclosure activity might not seem like it's very high, but somebody could be in default for thousands of days.
Yeah. Oh, no, it's insane. I mean, it's just really insane. You know, do you have a list, or maybe you can just, you know, name off a few of the, you know, the major states that are judicial foreclosure states?
Sure. The big ones are Florida, New York, New Jersey, and Connecticut.
So why? I mean, judicial foreclosure to me seems like an absolute disaster. Right or wrong? And then do you have an opinion as to why that law hasn't changed in those states?
Well, first off, it's just the setup of sort of how they have it. I think, frankly, that what's happened is you had two things. In judicial foreclosure, right, so somebody, they have to take them to court, and they have to go and obtain a judgment of foreclosure and sale. Well, as we have all heard about, there was a huge problem with robo-signing and a lot of the documentation not being in order when these cases were brought. And these cases were primarily brought by sort of these large mill factory kind of law firms that were just printing out these foreclosure actions and not really doing the proper due diligence. So in judicial foreclosure, when they started getting these cases started getting defended, there was a lot of holes that got exposed in the system of how they did it. And, you know, one of the big problems along the way was that these mortgages, since they were packaged up and sold into these securitized entities, there are certain transfers that needed to take place, and those transfers weren't taking place during the mania to get these mortgages packaged into these securities. So what's happened is now they're trying to go enforce these security, these mortgages, and a lot of that, a lot of the deficiencies were exposed in the judicial foreclosure process. So they were having difficulty moving those cases forward. And so that's, you know, so I'd say on the one hand, that's really one of the big reasons that why it got delayed up. Now they had to, a lot of the states responded, these judicial foreclosure states responded with requirements, such as in New York, for example, that the plaintiff's attorneys have to sign affidavits and certify that an attorney has really looked at the documentation and, you know, has to sign on a name that, yes, you know, everything is in order for us to be able to proceed with this foreclosure action. So that's just going to take time for them to get the documentation together and for somebody to look at and actually sign their name to it. You know, that's held up the process a bit. But then I think secondly, what's happened is that these states, in response to sort of seeing these problems with the documentation and the robo-signing, et cetera, they've all created these procedures in their court systems to say, hey, look, if it's a foreclosure case, before we're going to allow this thing to really get litigated on the particulars or on the substantive nature of the case, we're going to make both sides go to mandatory foreclosure mediation. And so it's been great for homeowners who really are trying to, you know, they've had a lot of frustration dealing directly with the banks or lost paperwork, et cetera. This puts the bank and their bank's lawyers on the hook to actually have to give these people a fair shot to try to get it modified. So that, you know, that's a process that probably can take anywhere from three months to a year in many times. I've seen some of those mediations go on for a year and a half. So I think both of those two things together have really dragged out the process of foreclosure, if the foreclosure has started. But again, I think that the bigger reason is simply that I think there's some sort of conscious effort on behalf of these entities, and maybe the government's is encouraging this, to really put on the brakes of bringing so many actions at once.
Yeah. Yeah. It just seems so unfair. I mean, listen, banks, their list of sins is so long as to be, you know, we don't have enough time to talk about them. But by the same token, I mean, it seems really unfair to lenders. It's not necessarily even the banks. It's the investors, of course, because these are all securitized, as we've discussed. It just seems really unfair that people should be able to live in their house for free for 3 years. I mean, doesn't it?
Yeah, I mean, on the one hand, you would think that, you know, it sounds like, well, they're being allowed to. But again, it's not even so much that they're allowed to. Again, remember, I stand firmly behind the belief that the majority of these people, if the banks or the entities that owned really wanted to move the foreclosure actions forward, they could. You know, the statistics that I've seen in New York, for example, show that, you know, only 5% of homeowners who are getting sued for foreclosure actually go to court and fight the case, which means that 95% of these cases could be won on just simply a default judgment. But again, they're not moving it forward, and I don't know why. I think it's got to be a conscious effort that maybe they don't want to overwhelm the market with all this, you know, new inventory. But again, I think it makes it for a difficult understanding of really what the landscape is. Are we really through the foreclosure process and all the bad times that everybody, you know, was really talking about back in 2009 and 2010, or is it still there? It's just not really, you know, really being, you know, being exposed. Are we really just kicking the can down the road, which is what I think is going on?
Well, America is very good at kicking the can down the road in so many ways.
That's right.
Yeah, we never want to take our medicine in this country, do we? We just want to, yeah, we'll do it tomorrow, you know. But that's another issue. So what are your thoughts on shadow inventory then?
Well, I think that there is just still a huge market that's out there. Since we didn't want to take our medicine right away, I think what's happened, it's become more politically acceptable for people to allow this situation to go on, because it allowed for the market to stabilize a little bit. I think the hope is that, look, if the economy starts to improve, people will be, you know, the anger against, the investment bank, et cetera, after the financial crisis, that's sort of gone away. And, you know, if you can go back to sort of business as usual as it used to be, so I think it's really allowing for that to happen. But, you know, frankly, I think that it's, you know, I think that it's at the end of the day, it's really going to hold up a true recovery for quite some time, because those properties are still going to start, you know, slowly coming out and hitting the market. But I think, you know, I think if we look back in 20 years, we'll probably end up saying that it was the right call, because it didn't allow for the market to be overwhelmed with all the foreclosure properties. So I guess time's going to have to tell.
Okay. And I want to get some context for this discussion, Chris. In what states do you practice law?
Our office represents homeowners in New York, New Jersey, and Connecticut.
Okay. So New York, New Jersey, and Connecticut. All fairly high-flying states. Certainly New York is. And when I say high-flying, I mean cyclical, non-linear markets like California, like, you know, South Florida, Miami, Fort Lauderdale, you know, fairly expensive markets for sure, right?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, absolutely.
Yeah. So when you talk about shadow inventory, I just want to try and make a distinction here. In these states with judicial foreclosures, that's where the shadow inventory problem would seem larger, wouldn't it?
Yeah, I would think so, because in the other markets, they can more quickly take over the property. But again, we don't know if they are. Again, like, you know, like, I don't know if they have the ability to take over the trust deeds in the non-judicial foreclosure states. I know that they have the ability to do it more quickly. I don't know if they're executing on it. From what I've seen and heard, it was a faster transition there, that they did take it over more quickly. But I got to think that there's probably still shadow inventory there as well, that, you know, where these situations where they can sort of execute and take the property over more quickly, but they don't.
Right. And I agree with you that there may well be that situation, but it's so much easier for the lenders to foreclose in those non-judicial states, right?
Oh, absolutely, 100%.
Yeah, I mean, in California, if you wanted to, you could foreclose in 111 days, right? You know,
that's right. Yeah, that's right. I mean, in New York, it could never be that fast.
I mean, I remember quoting stats on prior episodes a long time ago, saying that the average foreclosure in Florida took like 960 days. I mean, that is insanity.
That's right. That's right. Yeah, it can take that long to process. It can. But again, I think that, you know, I've seen foreclosures in New York that have been handled by sort of these larger, more mill firms, and they sort of have more of a process to it. And I think that those take longer than, you know, the guy down the street who might be, you know, holding on to one mortgage, and it's more personal. He's acting more quickly, because there are steps you can take to move it faster. I just think that they have so many files that they're dealing with that they're just sort of slowly getting through it.
With that in mind, what you really see here is, once again, the government with its old laws. I'm going to call these old-fashioned laws, judicial foreclosure. They're really inhibiting what's known as price discovery, because if they would let this inventory clear the market and resell and be reused by someone who will actually pay for it, then you'd have price discovery and you would have this healing much, much faster. It is, it's very frustrating.
Yeah, I know. I can see it. And I think also, too, is that, you know, you also have issues related to the title of these properties, I think, which is causing a lot of problems as well. Because I've even seen cases where, you know, the properties have been foreclosed on, yet the asset managers haven't moved forward to take the property over to try to resell it. I mean, it doesn't make sense to me, but I see it happening.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, no question about it. Okay, so talk to us about some of the things people can do if they're facing foreclosure, whether it be on a home in which they live or an investment property.
Well, the first thing you have to figure out is, you know, who is the mortgage servicer? Is this a mortgage servicer? And also, you know, who's the investor? Are these mortgage servicers and investors that are modification friendly? I'd say the far majority of them are receptive and open to modifications, especially if those loans have been taken out pre-January 1, 2009, because then for the most part, you'll have the Making Home Affordable program apply to these types of mortgages, and that's where they're trying to push to get the payments for principal, interest, taxes, and insurance down to around the 31% of gross income number. And so, you know, if it is, you can modify. Now, it used to be the case that only principal residences could be modified under this program. Well, that's been switched as of, I'd say, about 18 months ago to a program now where actually even if it's an investment property can also be considered for the Making Home Affordable HAMP program. So, you know, I'd say, you know, the first question is, you know, do you want to try to modify? And if you modify, there are a lot of those banks that have these programs out there. Aside from that, you know, one way to sort of, you know, try to get out from the situation as undamaged as you can would be to consider a short sale or sale of the property. And I say short sale because the majority of these properties are what you call upside down, meaning that the amount owed on the mortgages is greater than the property value. Well, unless you're going to come up with the difference in money, when you go to sell that property for its current market rate and you owe more than it, you're going to have to ask the bank to forgive that amount to allow you to sell for that lesser amount, and that's called a short sale. So a lot of people take that route as well. They want to try to get out of that situation and do it that way. Now, there are certain tax consequences involved with doing that. I think anybody who's going to consider these different approaches or avenues really needs to consider that, speak to their tax advisors regarding that and how to handle that, because it could be an unwelcome surprise if you have a cancellation of debt and don't treat it correctly for tax purposes. Other than that, you know, what's very interesting I found, and this was sort of the biggest surprise that I saw along the way, is that, you know, you've heard a lot of people talk about what's called a deed in lieu, or basically where they want to just sort of hand the property back over to the bank.
Yeah, deed in lieu of foreclosure, sure. And so what's going on there?
There I've seen that it is very difficult. That's probably the most difficult out of the three options.
Yeah, I agree.
Because the banks simply don't want to take the properties over that quickly. And they'll often, you know, make sure that you have the property completely vacant before they'll do that. Or they'll want to see you attempt to try to have the property sold via a short sale before they're willing to entertain it. So, you know, I've had a lot of situations where I have people, they've moved out of the property, they want to move on with their lives, and, you know, they can't because the deed still remains in their name.
I wonder why deed in lieu is the hardest. I mean, isn't that weird? And one thing I want to also ask you is, when you talk about loan modification, speak to the concept of modifying the rate or the terms versus the actual principal balance of the loan. But first, the deed in lieu question.
Yeah. So, you know, with the deed in lieu as to why they won't want to take it over, that's an excellent point. I mean, I've read some statistics that said that, look, when a property is sold via short sale, it's likely going to be sold for an amount greater than if the bank takes it over and tries to sell it as an REO. So I've seen that statistic a number of times. In fact, I've seen statistics say that a property sold at REO, you know, is likely to be sold for 25% lower than that same property if it were to be sold via short sale. So, you know, on the one hand, that could be one reason. I think, you know, realistically, though, on the other hand, they simply don't want to take on the liability of having to deal with this property. You have to maintain the property. A lot of the municipalities are getting upset when they see that banks have taken over properties and the property then goes in disrepair, or perhaps there's squatters sitting in there and then living in there. So I think that
there's one other just sort of high touch human aspect that I think happens a lot of times in the practice of a short sale, and that's the fact that, you know, the people are usually living in the property. And as they're doing their short sale, the sellers, or, you know, who are in default, they're seeing these people come through, and many times they get to meet them. And, you know, they don't want to rip the pipes out of the wall and steal the microwave because they met these people.
That's true. You know? No, that's a good point.
They'll usually leave the property in reasonably decent condition because it's kind of this, you know, they may have looked them in the eye, okay, if you will, and shaken their hand. And, you know, they know it's like a real person taking over the property versus some big faceless institution. Okay, so I think that's another reason short sales sell for more.
I would agree with that. Correct. Yeah. So I think that, they don't want to take these properties over. The municipalities oftentimes are holding them liable if the property's not, nicely maintained. I'm just supposing that that's got to be one of the reasons that they're not really in the business of trying to take title to these properties. But if you have somebody that's willing to hand you in the keys and they're not paying you the mortgage and you have the ability to take the keys back, I mean, it's common sense that we would think that, we'd want to go ahead and do that. And for whatever reason, they're not. So again, I think that, a large part of this shadow inventory, it's not just set up, it's not just a function of, it's the judicial system that's preventing this from happening. No, in fact, I think it's by design. The owners of these mortgages, these owners of these properties simply don't want to take it over for whatever business reason that is.
Talk to us for just a moment, if you would, about how someone should engage with a foreclosure defense attorney. Should they be expected to pay an upfront fee? Is it the typical, sign a retainer agreement for an hourly fee attorney relationship? Is it a flat fee? How does it work?
That's a great question. I think each situation's differently. I mean, I know that, and then also it's very important, what jurisdiction you're in and how they do it. In the New York, New Jersey, Connecticut area where we practice, we're governed by strict rules as to, the retainer agreement and the attorney-client relationship and how we do that. So we have flexibility in how we can design sort of how we're going to get paid. I think to do it hourly, most people probably aren't open to doing it hourly because they want to be able to sort of limit their expectation of what their investment's going to be in trying to produce a particular result. Some people do it differently. The way that we do it sometimes is we might do it by action or activity. So if we have to go to court, there's going to be a certain fee. If we have to do a certain type of pleading in court, there's going to be a certain type of fee. And then, then maybe you have some sort of blend for hourly on how you're going to do it if you're trying to, on the transactional part of trying to work out a deal. There's different ways to do it. I think what's important is to make sure, though, that you are certainly going with somebody that's licensed in the area of law of what they're doing. Certainly somebody that has an office that you're going to be seeing face-to-face. I mean, I've heard so many horror stories about people that they were enlisting people from out of state, from across the country to help them with a modification or something like that. And, that was bound to be a problem later on because if you can't, at the end of the day, if you can't sit down and look your attorney in the eye and look over the file together, you're really not knowing what they're going to do because they're simply on the other line of a telephone. That's not good enough. So I would say certainly, do your due diligence in meeting with them and sitting down. But then also, really have...
I just want to speak to that for a moment, though, and I hate to sound like such a skeptic, but that isn't foolproof by any means. I've met many attorneys who have not done very good work for me over the years that I've met in person. And certainly Mr. Bernie Madoff met a lot of people in his physical networking. So,
yeah, well, certainly.
He was hanging out at country clubs and charity events and met all those people and scammed them just the same.
Yeah, so, well, I mean, look, it's, yeah, anyway. I think that the reality is that if it's an in-person attorney that you're meeting with, I mean, the likelihood of really being scammed is one thing. I mean, I think you got to be realistic as to the result that you're looking to get. And you got to be upfront with the people that you're meeting with. Certainly, anybody that we're sitting down with, we work tirelessly to explain, these are the expectations. This is what you could see to have, and we don't take every case that walks in the door. I mean, that's our experience. Are there other people out there that are fraudsters? Sure. I think that you got to be careful in anything that you do.
Yep. Of course. Yeah. Okay. Anyway, go ahead with what you were saying, though.
Yeah. So I think that's the best way. Another way is that, there's local bar associations within most people's jurisdictions. So, in New York, pretty much every county has their own bar association. Certainly there they have referral networks that perhaps if you're looking for help, you can look for some there. So that's another way to find help.
Interesting stuff. Interesting stuff. What would you say the average, I guess you probably sort of think in loan amount, and I doubt that as a lawyer you're thinking too much on the numbers, but, just anecdotally, do you have an idea as to the average loan amount that you're negotiating, average mortgage size?
Yeah, and the average mortgage size, you know, it really depends whether it's New York, New Jersey, or Connecticut. I would say in New York, in the areas that we work, it's probably about $500,000. I would say in Connecticut, depending on which part, you're probably somewhere closer to around $300,000. And I would say in New Jersey, we're $300,000. Yeah, and in New Jersey, I would say it's probably somewhere around the $250,000.
Uh-huh. Okay, and we should note that's the loan amount, which may or may not be close to the property value. So yeah.
Oh yeah, it's almost never close to the property value because that's the loan amount. But then you have maybe all the back payments. So when you really add up all that stuff, it could be maybe 50 to 100% higher. That's owed. But then you got to look at the property values. Oftentimes these properties were purchased. Overwhelmingly, they're purchased during the boom times of 2004 to 2006 or 2007. And so a lot of these properties have dropped from those highs, maybe in value, maybe I'd say at least, you know, 25% to 50% in some cases. So you have a situation where there's a lot of people that owe a lot more money on their property, on their home than it's worth. And what happens is that I think that, you know, a lot of the government has done, has pushed Fannie and Freddie Mac, who are the majority owners of most of these loans, to some extent to try to give relief in terms of modifications. But that's primarily only been to give modifications in terms of reducing the interest rates that are being applied, which is helpful. And, you know, extending the terms out, you know, that can allow somebody to have a lower payment. But I think if you're really going to look at it, sooner or later, a lot of these people who are getting those types of modifications, if they remain underwater, significantly underwater, they sooner or later are going to make the business decision that, you know what, it's not worth putting the money in anymore. They're going to want to walk. So I think, and the problem's been that Fannie and Freddie have not been granting principal reductions. And I think what needs to happen is, for if we really want to see encouragement in trying to get through this problem, the modifications, the Fannie and Freddie should be allowed to give principal reductions. I think it's going to go a long way.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, good points. Well, thank you so much. And I just want to stress, you know, the distinction of that the markets you're dealing in are these high-priced markets. This is not the Midwest. It's not the South. So, of course, that market varies pretty dramatically around the country, of course. You know, I love it when these people, Chris, and I'm sure you'll appreciate this too, they go on CNBC and they talk about the housing market, in quotes, as if there's some single national housing market in a country as large and diverse as the United States with about 400 metropolitan statistical areas. So, you know, good points. And I judicial foreclosure, I tell you, if I had my own state and I ran it, I wouldn't have judicial foreclosure because that's just too crazy. We'll see how this works itself out. And gosh, I wonder if these, you know, multi-million dollar New York little tiny condos are going to see a drop in value. You know, they may.
Well, no, I think I think you hit it on the head when you said that each market is a different market. I mean, in the markets that we're talking about, I mean, Manhattan is probably completely excluded from the conversation. I mean, that's a market all its own, and I don't think that hasn't suffered a bit.
Yeah. But I still think it's way too expensive, and you know, it's just I don't know. I just think the world is changing a lot. You know, I used to say, you know, look at the three cardinal rules of real estate were location, 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 right? Everybody's heard that. And I think that's becoming, it's still certainly important. I mean, everybody wants to be in a well-located area. But, you know, that's becoming less important as we see these digital nomads and people, you know, running pretty good businesses from all over the planet. I mean, they can live in these lifestyle destinations now. You don't need to be in Silicon Valley and to have a tech company, although it's cool if you are. I get it. There are benefits. But it's just that geography is a little less meaningful than it's been, for sure. Okay? And that's my point.
Yeah. I would agree with that. I think what's interesting to note about Manhattan, though, and what's happening there is that, you know, so much of the property prices and everything that's shooting up are
foreign
investment. Yeah. There's people who are just parking money They may never live. They may never sleep a night in the apartments that they're buying.
Let me tell you what's really interesting about that too. I mean, we have lots of investors from all over the world that contact us to invest in American real estate. And America has always been known as the Brinks truck. You know, where wealthy or upper middle class, if there are any, there's not that many, but it's mostly real wealthy foreigners, whether they be Chinese, Russian, Ukrainian, you know, South American, whatever, right? They always want to park some money in America. And I think that really, even now, even as mismanaged as the U.S. is, you know, I mean, it's still, we've still got that, you know. I think that bodes really well for the U.S. I really do. Good stuff. Well, hey, it's been really fascinating talking to you. Give out your website. Tell people where they can find out more.
Absolutely. Thank you. You can reach me at www.cabanillaslaw.com, which is CABANILLASLAW.com.
Chris Cabanillas, thank you so much for joining us today.
My pleasure. Thank you.
This show is produced by the Hartman Media Company, all rights reserved. For distribution or publication rights and media interviews, please visit www.hartmanmedia.com or email media@hartmanmedia.com. Nothing on this show should be considered specific personal or professional advice. Please consult an appropriate tax, legal, real estate, or business professional for individualized advice. Opinions of guests are their own, and the host is acting on behalf of Platinum Properties Investor Network, Inc., exclusively.